Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey. Our guest today started her journey as a curious kid in Fiji, staring out at the ocean. That curiosity led her to become a scientist, spending years studying the human brain and how it works. But along the way, she realized that understanding our minds wasn't enough if she didn't also fight for the world we live in. Dr. Suhaila Ali is a neuroscientist who became a climate justice warrior. She has moved from the laboratory to the front lines, helping organizations like Jubilee Australia hold big corporations accountable. She joins us to talk about why climate change isn't just hurting our land, it's hurting our mental health, and why saving the Pacific means taking care of each other's spirits, not just our shores. Dr. Suhaila Ali, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're very, very excited to be interviewing you and talking to you today. We often hear about your big career achievements, and there is a lot of them. But I want to start in Fiji. When you close your eyes and think of home, what is the first sound or smell that comes to mind?
The first thing that immediately comes to mind is the smell and sounds of my parents cooking. So I think I have a lot of really strong, fond memories tied up with food, as I think a lot of people do. So my parents made a lot of different things, mainly Indian food, because we're Indo-Fijian. So, you know, dal is a staple, all kinds of curries. Crab curry is probably one of my favorite dishes.
Fave.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm hungry. Thank you for that. I'm not going to go eat now. Now, you once said that your family life was vibrant. Mm. Can you paint us a picture of what, I guess, and we talked about the food and growing up around all that beautiful food. I'm wondering who was there around the dining table and what were the conversations like growing up?
At the dining table, it would have predominantly been my mom and dad and my sister, Ruhi. Shout out to Ruhi. And I think in the earlier years, there was my mom's father, my nana, my grandfather, but he passed away when I was still fairly small. So I don't really have memories of him. But yeah, I think we spoke about a lot of different things. We were always the kind of unusual family in that my father was Muslim and my mom was sort of Hindu, grew up Hindu and practices, you know, a lot of sort of Hindu ceremonies and things. So I feel like we were exposed to quite a range of different things and cultural things, religious things. And then I was sent to the international school in Suva as well. So again, exposed to a lot of, you know, things from overseas, and Fiji itself is a very multicultural place. So yeah, I feel like there was a lot of diversity in our conversations as a result.
What was the first thing you remember trying to take apart or understand as a kid?
Yeah. So I have this memory of physically trying to take apart like a toy that I think was maybe like a little telephone type thing. Like some kind of like sort of mechanical-ish thing, but like, you know, plasticky. And yeah, I have a memory of trying to take it apart to try and figure out how it worked.
Wow. Was there a particular elder or community member who saw that curious spark in you early on and encouraged it?
I mean, I think my mom in particular, because she was always very much into books and reading and even like languages. And she she has this incredible vocabulary, and she's just this, like, probably world champion level Scrabble player, I would say. She's so good at Scrabble, to the point where it's like, you don't really want to play her because she's too good. You know what I mean?
Oh, this is gold for me. I aspire to be at that level. Let me tell you.
Oh my gosh. Yes, you should play my mom. She will definitely challenge you.
Yeah, she will definitely beat me.
Yeah. But I think she really encouraged that curiosity in me. You know, I was naturally inclined towards books, and she, you know, got books for me, and she definitely saw that I was very into learning, and she definitely, you know, helped sort of kindle that spark.
Now, talk to me about moving countries, because that's a huge change for a child to have to undergo. So when you left Fiji for Australia, what was the one thing that you were most afraid to leave behind?
I think probably, like, it's a pretty basic answer, but I would say my family.
My
sister left after she finished high school. She moved overseas to Australia as well. And then, yeah, so it was me and my parents, and I was very close with them. And, you know, there's a lot of comfort that you have, you know, being with your parents. And I was very excited to be, you know, living an independent life and doing things on my own. But I think, yeah, that's probably, you know, that sense of familiarity and comfort and food and everything that your parents provide. I think that was a bit scary, leaving that behind.
And on the flip side of that, what was the most surprising thing about landing in your new life in Australia?
Yeah, I think this is a common experience of migrants from, you know, non-white countries in particular. I think it was, you know, you grow up in a place with majority brown people and, like, and again, like I said earlier, really multicultural place. So from being sort of a part of the majority to then being a minority in Australia, like, that was a really interesting and sort of surprising experience. Was like, oh, I'm sort of then reckoning with, like, what your identity means in this new place and, yeah, becoming, like, sort of a racialized person. I think that wasn't something I really had thought much about until I moved here.
So upon moving to Australia, you know, in Australia, did you feel a heavy responsibility to succeed for the family or for the community you left behind? Or did you find that your parents gave you the freedom just to be yourself?
Yeah, it's a cliche for, like, you know, Asian parents in particular to have these really strong expectations of their children. And, like, I wouldn't say, you know, my parents definitely did want to see me, you know, do well at school, do well at university and succeed, but I didn't feel that pressure, like, you know, that I've seen other kids experience where, you know, particularly those parents who have, some might say, like, quite a narrow view of what success looks like in terms of being a medical doctor or being a lawyer. And I think because my parents, like, they looked beyond just sort of, like, success in terms of, like, career and making money. They definitely wanted us to, like, you know, be happy and do things that we enjoyed doing. So, but I, like, personally, I loved sort of academic achievements, and I feel like a lot of pressure came from myself, honestly. But yeah, I think my parents, like, did appreciate me doing well at things, but I never really felt like, you know, there was, like, pressure on me to pursue a particular path or, you know, ever making me feel bad for not succeeding in something, for example. So I was lucky in that way.
You went from studying general science to studying the human brain, which is a big jump. I'm wondering, what was the question you were trying to answer by looking so closely at the way we think or how we think?
So I studied biology in undergraduate. And yeah, sort of towards the end of my degree, I started getting really interested in neuroscience and the human brain. And I used to, when I finished, I think it was after I finished university, I started a blog, actually, where I was doing a bit of science writing, because when I was at university, I did some science writing for, like, my student newspaper, and I really loved it. So I was like, I'll keep this going on my own little WordPress, you know.
Oh, WordPress, we love.
So, yeah, I remember writing about this because I wanted to sort of articulate why it was that I got interested in neuroscience. So I actually managed to like dig up my old blog, and it is a bit cringy to look back at your old writing. But yeah, I had this piece where I was talking about, oh, I think I submitted it for a science writing competition. That's right. But yeah, there's a line that I'll read from you that I think captures why I got into neuroscience and kind of the broader question that I was particularly interested in, which is, the universe is astounding and there's so much yet to be explained, but what amazes me above all is my ability to question it in the first place. It was this marveling at sort of human consciousness and, you know, the fact there's so much, there's so many aspects of neuroscience, but that really fundamental sort of like, yeah, idea of self and consciousness, I think is what really, really grabbed me initially.
And so did, you know, spending a lot of time looking at these big questions and the brain and humans and the way that we exist and all that, did that change how you saw people around you?
For me, when I started formally studying neuroscience for my master's, I was in a lab that studied mental disorders. Schizophrenia specifically is what I was looking at. I think having this better understanding of mental health and mental disorders, like particularly having this sort of biological basis and even getting down to like the cellular level of things, I think that really affected how I viewed, yeah, mental health in particular, because I think growing up, I didn't have such an awareness of mental health. But, you know, I think it's quite easy to, well, not necessarily like dismiss things, but not understand that a lot of these disorders do have a physical basis. I mean, there are a lot of external environmental factors that also interplay with mental health and how mental disorders develop. But yeah, I think it was really interesting and just, yeah, gave me quite a new perspective on how the brain works and also doesn't work sometimes, you know.
So you spent years sort of studying mental health across the whole populations. I'm wondering, like, yeah, what made you want to look at mental health on such a big scale?
Yeah, so after my master's in neuroscience, where I'd been working in a lab, which was really fascinating, but I found that maybe I wasn't the most well-suited to lab work. And I was also getting more interested in sort of the human element, because again, I was working with mice.
Mice, did you say?
Yes, with mice. I was working on a mouse model of schizophrenia. So
I have so many questions, or probably won't.
Happy to go into that at another time. But yeah, my master's thesis was looking at sort of the neurodevelopmental biology of schizophrenia, so looking at like early brain development and some of the particular, you know, like neurons and things that are involved in how the disorder develops. So anyway, so I did that, and then I was not so keen on doing more lab work, but also getting more interested in the human side of things and looking at, you know, patterns of disease and health at a larger scale, because I got into this sort of biological work because I was interested in how things work at this very molecular micro level with cells and proteins and things like that. But then I, yeah, really wanted to zoom out and look at how things played out at a population level in order to then sort of, you know, understand how we can influence health and improve health at this larger scale as well.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey, and I'm speaking with the incredible Suhaila Ali. Let's pivot a little bit. Let's go from your science to into climate justice. I'm wondering, what was the specific moment or day or realization that you had where science alone may not be enough to solve the problems that are pressing or that you care about?
It actually came during the final sort of study in my PhD. So my PhD was in epidemiology. So again, this population level study of human health. And the final study in my PhD was trying to understand the kind of mechanisms underpinning this particular issue. So the issue I was looking at was premature mortality in people with severe mental disorders. So I used this methodology called systems thinking to kind of try and map out these different causal factors and pathways. And what I found was that some of the key factors are something that we call in public health social determinants of health. So these are things like housing, like having, you know, social support and having a stable income and things like that. So these social factors. And those factors then go on to affect, you know, other factors, like, for example, being able to afford healthy food. And then, you know, those have direct impacts on your physical health. And yeah, I realized that some of these factors, they can't be changed by health interventions. You know, for example, with coming back to housing as an example, you know, in order to fix this housing crisis, we need to attack the root causes of the problem, which lie in, you know, well, capitalism, but you know, there are policies outside of the health world that need to be changed in order to affect these sort of social determinants, which then really shape people's physical and mental health. So it was, yeah, it was that study that really showed me that, you know, health interventions are incredibly important as well, but that mm-hmm. we need to be looking sort of beyond that as well.
Your work with Connecting Climate Minds, which is a massive global project where you united voices from across Oceania to start a new agenda for well-being, sounds super fascinating. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us simply, what does it look like when we connect climate change with mental health?
Yeah, so the Connecting Climate Minds was this global project where it was the goal of the project was to try and set up research and action agendas to address this intersection of climate and mental health, recognizing that there were some particular gaps in knowledge and particular regions of the world and populations that were underrepresented, particularly from the global south, and just trying to do the work in a more coordinated way. So, yeah, climate change influences mental health in a lot of different ways. And yeah, that would again be a whole different conversation. But it was coming back to Connecting Climate Minds, it was trying to identify what research needs to be done and then what actions need to be taken in order to address the impacts of climate change on mental health.
There is a lot of talk about resilience in the Pacific. Mm. As a mental health expert, do you think we rely too heavily on that word?
That's a really interesting question. I think in the context of health, yeah, you often see deficit framing, for example, around, I mean, actually not just health, even climate change, where Pacific Island countries and Pacific populations are termed like vulnerable, for example. Mm-hmm. And then the strengths of Pacific Islanders is, you know, sometimes under-recognized. But then on the flip side, I think then, yeah, maybe you can sometimes see maybe there's too much emphasis on resilience and then not necessarily recognizing, you know, what Pacific populations might need. Mm-hmm. And then in the context of mental health specifically, some work that has been done by Pacific researchers looking at Pacific populations in particular, they found resilience came out as a really important theme, and resilience as like a protective factor for climate and mental health, and, you know, connecting resilience, or like the way that resilience shows up in terms of connection to family and culture and spirituality. So yeah, I think there's a balance that needs to be found, because yeah, Pacific people are incredibly resilient, but you know, you still have, for example, in terms of climate change, a lot of need in terms of adaptation and finance and things like that. So there is still a lot of support needed, you know, particularly from developed countries like Australia.
You are now the director of the Climate Justice program at Jubilee Australia. Now, that feels like a move from studying the problem to essentially fighting it. I'm wondering, was that a deliberate choice for you?
Yes, it was a very deliberate choice. There were quite a few reasons that I wanted to move into this advocacy space. I think primarily it was this desire to take kind of more tangible and practical action. And Jubilee is sort of unique in the broader kind of Australian climate movement space, where we're a research center, so we do research-based advocacy. So there are some other sort of think tanks and research organizations that do this kind of things. But yeah, it's a great fit for me because I still love doing research, but it's now doing it in a different context. So rather than an academic setting, it's specifically in line, specifically for the purposes of, you know, advocating on particular issues. And it feels a lot more sort of practical and meaningful, I think.
And Jubilee Australia does some tough work holding companies responsible for their actions. Mm-hmm. How does your background in science help you when you were standing up to these big corporations?
Yeah, I think it's particularly valuable for developing a strong and robust evidence base. Mm-hmm. So, you know, gathering information, gathering data to then be able to, you know, for example, debunk some of the claims that, let's say, the fossil fuel industry is making.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, it's doing a lot of like investigating and then like exposing the things that they do. So they're very helpful skills, I think, for doing this kind of work.
Now, you wear so many hats, you know, you're a researcher, advocate, director. Is there a common thread that ties all those roles together for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to sound so cheesy, but...
I love cheesy.
Okay, good. I think it's overall about, like, making the world a better place, you know?
Period.
Like, so, you know, the reason that I did research was because I wanted to figure out how to make the outcomes for people with mental disorders better. And then for working on climate stuff, it's like I'm trying to stop the climate crisis from getting worse. So it's, I think what ties these things together is like, yeah, this desire for trying to improve things and help people, I guess.
Is there a particular story from your work in and around the Pacific that has stayed with you and that reminds you why this work is so urgent?
There's this incredible youth climate activist from Tuvalu who recently collaborated on like a short documentary about her activism and climate activism, I think, in more generally in Tuvalu. So this was a collaboration with the Australia Institute. And I think what often sticks with me is young activists who from such a young age have thrown themselves headfirst into trying to tackle this problem. And, you know, for me, I think I was aware of things from a younger age, but I wasn't, you know, a full-blown activist at the age of like 16 or however. Some kids start even younger than that, right?
Mm.
Now. So I think that often sticks with me because, you know, for some kids, this is what they've grown up with. This is their entire lives. And they feel compelled to act because so many adults aren't acting.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think I take a lot of inspiration and I'm just always so impressed by these young people and gives me a lot of hope as well that, you know, the new generation will take better care of the planet than previous generations have.
Yeah, 1,000%. Sometimes I'm like, oh, actually, the kids are all right, actually.
Yeah.
When you see, you know, how politically minded they are at earlier ages, mm-hmm. and how much they do care in a way that, you know, that a lot of generations before them and weren't necessarily thinking about those things at particular ages. So,
yeah,
they themselves are also as inspiring for us older generations as well to watch.
Absolutely.
And another thing to add to your list, you've mm-hmm. also been involved with Pacifica for Palestine Australia.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see the connection between the fight for climate justice in the Pacific and other fights for justice around the world?
Yeah, so I think like all of these struggles are very much interconnected. And I think a common thread is the root causes of a lot of these injustices being, you know, colonialism, and how this has, you know, disrupted ties between Indigenous peoples in particular and their lands, and contributed, yeah, to all sorts of inequalities in terms of almost every aspect of life, including health inequalities, for example. But there's issues in the Pacific itself, for example, like West Papua is a good example of this ongoing fight for Indigenous sovereignty and self-determination, and, you know, atrocities being committed by a not sort of, yeah, colonial sort of state. And these are shared struggles, you know. So, yeah, I think it's about looking at the underlying causes and connecting these struggles, because I think people often, well, I think from some of this advocacy that we've done, some of the responses that we've gotten from, including from people in the Pacific, is why should I care about something that's happening in this other part of the world? And, you know, what about like what's happening in West Papua? But like, this is what we're trying to say, is that these, you know, these are shared fights. These are the same kinds of enemies. You know, it's about having this shared humanity, and the quote, none of us are free until all of us are free. So recognizing that all of our shared struggles, and particular people who are struggling for self-determination and sovereignty, like these fights are definitely interconnected.
Do you ever feel a clash between Western science and the things your culture has taught you?
Yes. I think coming back to connecting climate minds as an example, I think I spoke to it a little earlier, where I was talking about, you know, even just the way that mental health is conceptualized. In our research and action agenda that we ended up developing, we ended up making a very deliberate choice to conceptualize mental health alongside well-being. So we weren't just looking at mental health, we were looking at mental health and well-being in order to reflect that more holistic view of health and mental health. So I think, yeah, particularly there are so many different cultural contexts, and there are therefore different ways that, you know, mental health and ill health shows up in different cultural contexts, and things that aren't so neatly categorized or fit into, you know, neat little boxes like Western psychiatry often demands. So yeah, that was probably a very clear-cut example of where we saw that direct kind of clash between Western science and Indigenous ways of being and knowing and doing.
Sahela, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing and imparting all your life's journey, but also all this wisdom. You have reminded us that the climate crisis isn't just about the rising temperatures. It's about the health of our minds and the strength of our spirits. You bridge the world of science and the world of soul with so much grace. Your work challenges us to look deeper, to care more fiercely, and to understand that saving our planet is also about saving each other. Thank you for your brilliance, your fight, and for sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Wendy. Big vinakavakalevu.
You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Wendy Mockey.